Hello and welcome to the Idaho Reports podcast. I'm Logan Finney. The United States Supreme Court recently allowed the state of Idaho to enforce House Bill 71, a statute that was passed that outlaws gender-affirming care for minors in the state of Idaho. Here to discuss that bill and its effects on Idahoans is Dr. Marvin Alviso, family medicine practitioner in Boise. Dr. Alviso, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, to orient us in this conversation, what does your practice look like in Boise? And can you talk to me specifically about your focus on the LGBTQ community?
Sure. So I'm a family physician, and I've been practicing in Boise for the past 12 years. And my practice of focus has mostly been LGBTQ in the past like 5-7 years. But I came to Boise to complete the fellowship in HIV primary care. And then so the bulk of my practice is still like HIV patients. And I also take care of like PrEP patients. And then more recently, I did start taking care of adolescents, children, and adults who are gender diverse and seeking to transition.
The law, when it was first passed, it has kind of a few bullet points of the different things that it outlaws for minors. That covers both the medication side of things like puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones, but it also outlaws surgeries for this purpose. And it was a point that was brought up often during that debate in the legislature. A lot of people said these surgeries don't happen for minors regardless. And we even heard some echoes of that debate in the legislature this year, people talking about removing healthy body parts. Can you confirm for me whether or not these type of surgeries happen for minors in the state?
As far as I know, like these surgeries doesn't happen in this state. I mean, no surgeons would touch any like minor here to do any gender affirming surgery. And we're just really limited as well with what surgeries can be performed here. Cause like Idaho is not like a center for like surgical procedures for transgender care. So I can tell you that none of my patients who was under 18 are getting surgeries here.
The transgender and non-binary people who I've interacted with, there's a broad range of what we could call transitioning or non-conforming with the gender binary. There's social elements to that. There can be medical elements to that. There's a wide range of things that fall under that umbrella of transitioning. When it comes specifically to gender-affirming medical care, when someone comes to your office to talk to you as a doctor about this type of thing, what are you talking to them about?
So, I mean, so when they come into the clinic, I usually can get like referrals from pediatricians in the area, from counselors, and then other providers that are not very comfortable with providing gender-affirming care. So in some cases, I already have like a hunch on what they are seeking. So that's when I get the referral and then we proceed with the visit. So what I provide would be like a diagnosis of gender dysphoria and then reviewing records from previous providers, from counselors, or if there's none, I do refer them if the diagnosis is a little bit like it's not like straightforward. So I do use that.
What does the standard of care look like for transgender patients? How do you approach deciding whether it's appropriate for someone to try something like a hormone blocking medication or cross-sex hormones, taking testosterone or estrogen, for example?
Sure. So let's just, I mean, I think really our focus today would be like for like the transgender like minor. So whenever they come in first, so we do a full evaluation. It's not just like set and so on. I will immediately put people on like hormones or puberty blockers. I mean, I assess them first. Like, again, like I said, like if they have been referred from pediatrician, or they've been referred by counselors, that's always like a good thing, because then at least I have something to back up on already to really like do that diagnosis for gender dysphoria. But let me tell you that not all patients with gender dysphoria need like a referral from a counselor, but it's almost always certain that it's helpful. So when I get that diagnosis, I do like a complete history, starting from like birth, like how did this questioning started, or when did they notice that their gender identity differ from their outside appearance? So it takes a lot. And then if there are parents in there or a guardian, I also involve them, like adding to the history. When did they start noticing something's a little bit like different? So that's how we proceed with this, and I evaluate them. So for people who are before puberty, so that's where we set like what treatment is appropriate for them. So anybody who's before puberty, we do just like either social affirmation for them, which means like honoring the patient's like desire for name change, for pronoun use, the way they dress, the way they want to be addressed in school or anywhere. So we're respecting that one, and we're just affirming. Like I tell the patients, yeah, I mean, this is a diagnosis, and it is normal for you to feel this way, or like behave that way. And then once, because we don't do anything pre-puberty, so there's really no medical treatment before puberty. And then there are ways that we can determine if the patient is in puberty already. There are clinical lab, so there are lab findings that we order, like there are laboratory that we order, and then there's also like examination or like physical findings that helps us aid whether to determine this patient is in puberty or not. So if we determine them in puberty, which is a combination of the labs and like examination, if they would allow us to, then we proceed with puberty blockers if they meet the criteria for like the gender dysphoria and they want to start with puberty blockers. So it's a long process also, like it's not all insurance approved this one. So we get some baseline labs to begin with, making sure that they really meet the gender dysphoria criteria. So in addition to that, there are also like things that we can consider, like because there a lot of these patients are neurodiverse, meaning to say they also have concomitant diagnosis of ADHD. We also want to rule out bipolar disorder or depression or anxiety that's causing this before really making that diagnosis that this is gender dysphoria and they're appropriate for puberty blockers. So it's not just like if you meet the criteria, we want to rule out other conditions that needs to be treated first before treating them with puberty blockers. So after that, like when we determine that they are a good candidate for puberty blockers, and the guardians, the parents are also on board with that, then we start treatment. And then a year or two after, like whichever their age is, that's when we kind of have like a base plan for them. Like we start with puberty blocker and then add cross-sex hormones like eventually. Because really the goal of gender transition at this age is for them to be at par with their peers. Meaning to say, and that's why we don't start puberty blocker like when they're 18 already, because they've met puberty already. So you want to start that puberty blocker when they're at puberty and introduce cross-sex hormones, just like you would see with their friends. Like at 15 or 16, a female is developing like their chest already, like they're developing curves already. So you want this patient who has gender dysphoria to be at that level also. So that, I mean, like for mental health, it also brings about like calmness and then like, oh, I'm developing just like my friends. So that is really the goal why we start at this age, for them to be at par with peer and for a better mental health feeling, I guess. Yeah. So after that, then we move them to transition until like they're 17 or 18, when they just come on, just full on, like just cross-sex hormones, which they desire. And then also at that point, like then we can start arranging for surgical after when they reach 18, like referral, because a lot of times like it takes a year or two to be seen by a surgical consult. So sometimes we start arranging that one at 17 and a half, like start the process already of like, okay, let's think about referring you in like the next 6 months and having them call the insurance, which one's covered, how much are they going to save for it. So that's kind of like the timeline, but I do make sure that I see them like every 6 months. We do labs every 3 months for puberty blockers. There's the injection, and then kind of we reassess them like at the minimum every 3 months. They need to be seen, and then lab draw every 6 months. So it's an intensive process, and the patients are aware of the blood draw, of like the visits. So, and sometimes we can incorporate like well-child visit in addition to as well.
One of the ironies for me as a layperson, I'm cisgender, I'm not transgender, but my understanding is kind of part of the point of puberty blockers early on, it's A, the mental health benefits that we talked about earlier, but also B, it kind of preempts the need for some of the surgical interventions later on that lawmakers are so concerned about.
So there, remember again, like when we put patients on puberty blocker, we're pausing puberty until which gives them time. So you are right on this avoids like surgery down the line. So let's take for an example a transgender female. So meaning to say I was born male and transitioning as female, and we put them on puberty blocker. So when you put them on puberty blocker at their age around 15, then we are trying to pause them from growing like the tall, like a lot of like transgender female doesn't want to be like 6 feet tall. We are also pausing them to develop these masculinized jaw lines or like this very definitive feature in the brow and the nasal area that makes them look more masculinized, as well as we're also like pausing for them to develop like that deeper voice. Which, so all of these that I mentioned has a surgical implication if this has been developed later on. Meaning to say, like, if I'm transitioning female and I develop like Adam's apple, like these jaw lines, and then like deeper voice, then these have to be fixed later on. But if you give them puberty blocker and start with them with cross-sex hormones, like at a good age, at an appropriate age, then you prevent these surgeries. So we're just not talking about bottom surgery here. So there are also like other facial like stuff or facial features that you are avoiding to be surgically modified in the future. Yeah, and also like body features, like body fat redistribution that's being avoided. And then for transitioning male, there are other things that the chest will not fully like develop, so like there is like a less chance for like surgery, although unless they really want a top surgery, that will be done, but it decreases like their dysphoria of having like a well-developed chest into like when they're 16 or 17 when they really don't want that. So there are it's not we're not just talking about genitalia when we do like these puberty blockers or like hormone therapy. It's the totality of their gender identity that we are trying to shape.
So if you have a young person who's maybe questioning their gender identity and you start them on puberty blockers, like you said, it pauses things, it gives a little bit of time. If that family and that minor decides that pursuing this kind of care is not for them and they do identify with the gender they were assigned at birth and they stop taking those puberty blockers, is there any sort of long-term effect from that? We heard lawmakers also in their debates say that these type of treatments can have long-term lasting effects on people.
So the debate on that one, so we have a medical condition called precocious puberty. So these patients start puberty when they're 6 or 7. So meaning to say an assigned female at birth starts having menstruation at 6 or 7 years old, starts developing breasts, and this medication was made for that. So this disease has been around for years, and these medications have been around for years as well. So we've been treat, and so that's the parallel that we're doing for gender dysphoria. We're just pausing their puberty until they're old enough to be like to start cross-sex hormones with parental approval, as well as when they fit into that category of puberty. So when we treat precocious puberty and we unpause that when they're like 9 or 10, then puberty just resumes. So there is no like. So puberty resumes, and I have personally like a family member of mine that was diagnosed with precocious puberty and then started on puberty blocker, and after 3 or 4 years it was on pause, and she's just developing just like a regular 14-year-old female. the information that they're trying to push out in order for this law to be taken into effect has been like proven like wrong already with like the brain development that's not change, and then the fertility is not change, because as soon as you stop the puberty blockers in 3 to 4 months, everything should like go back as if it was when it was supposed to start 3 or 4 years ago.
So this has been the way of the world for a while now. Idaho passed this law, which was supposed to take effect of January 1st of this year. That law had been blocked by a court injunction by the Federal District Court here in Idaho. Now that the Supreme Court has lifted that injunction and allowed the law to take effect for everyone except for the two specific transgender teenagers who are party to this lawsuit, how has that changed the landscape for you and for your patients?
Well, it's a devastating news, both for providers here in Boise who provide gender-affirming care, as well as for patients themselves. I actually had a patient who I am ready to counsel with cross-sex hormones. He's been on puberty blocker for a year, and then I kind of told him like what the effects of testosterone, and then I was pulled from the room by my nurse and said, "You've got to see this, and this is bad." And then so I saw that article. I have to tell that to the parent and to the patient, and it was just devastating to see like his eyes like just like really teary, and then the dad can just was just like really not nodding their head, was just like can't do anything about this. And I'm sure they were just really composed about that visit, but so you can imagine like your lifeline being cut off like immediately. It also poses like a legal and ethical dilemma for me. Like, do we follow? Of course, like I don't want to be imprisoned for this. I mean, I would want to do what's best for a patient, which is science backed, and this is what's supposed to be. And then we have these legal things that I cannot do because of politics meddling with medicine. So I just feel defeated at that point. Like, I mean, granted that this has just been, it's already Thursday, it's just been like 3 days, and I know the repercussions for families, for patients, for even and even providers. I mean, it's far-reaching, I'm pretty sure. And we're just like realizing how chaotic this will be.
This law imposes a felony penalty with a sentence of up to 10 years in prison for doctors like you who provide care now that the law has taken effect. And that's an even stricter, a longer possible sentence than the state's abortion law, which is now in effect. How does that weigh on you in your day-to-day as you're seeing these patients now?
Well, just like I said, like it's an ethical dilemma. So I think what we're gonna do would be like so just right now, like I've been looking at all of the kids, and then I have to like start stopping their prescriptions. I mean, that's one thing that I'm doing. And then number two, getting a list of the patients, because there's still more work to be done. Just because that I am not allowed to provide prescriptions for them, that doesn't stop my duty as a provider for them. I still have to look out for them in ways that I can, which includes like referring them to out-of-state providers, which I've done in other patients before. The ones that had to move, because there are patients who moved already because of that, so I have to refer them out of state. But the ones that we have here right now, and granted, there are a few because I am a provider, and there are other providers that provide gender-affirming care for kids. That's my plan, is to like get a list and try to refer them out of state.
When this law was first passed last year, did you see a lot of families leaving Idaho to avoid it? And then follow up to that, in the give or so weeks since the law has actually taken effect, has that changed at all what you've been hearing from your patients?
There has been, I wouldn't say like a mass exodus, but there have been people leaving the state for that matter. And not just kids, even adults. I mean, I have one patient who personally said, "I just feel I'm just really not welcome here, so I'm moving out of state." And he is a 22-year-old, has a job here, stable family, just like, and I've never seen him that afraid before. But he did voice out his concern. So that's one example. And parents and looking out for their children, like finding other states that will be welcoming. I've had patients who left like right after that was even before the injunction. And then after the injunction, I mean, I was just really hoping that it'll stay forever. So I was still continuing practicing medicine, like a science-based medicine for gender-affirming care for these patients. And then, but before that, I also had preparations, like for people who's going to be like 17 and a half. Like we provide them because for estrogen and for estrogen and spironolactone, I can prescribe a 6 month supply. So I just tell them like, hey, just save some money. I'll give you if this injunction like really push through, at least you'll have 6 months of prescription, and then you're gonna turn 18, and then we can like take care of you legally. But for some patients, that's true and was okay. But for some, I really have to like tell them like we really have to stop like prescriptions and let's refer you out. So that's when I started referring out patients before the injunction. And then when the injunction happened, I kind of like re resumed care for them and they stopped. They canceled their appointments with the other referral in other states.
When you're ref trying to refer these patients out of state, how difficult is that? We anecdotally, as a journalist during the COVID pandemic, there was a lot of moving patients trying to find room for places in other states. Obviously, this is not anything of that scale, but the medical system is complicated and it's hard to get appointments for people. How difficult is that to find room for these patients now that they can't get care in Idaho?
What I've been doing is like, so there is a concierge medicine in Seattle. So for patients who has a little bit of money who can afford these like telehealth visits, I mean, that's an option for them. They can actually call them and schedule an appointment for them. But for those who have like Medicaid or like private insurance and cannot afford like concierge medicine, like we try to refer them out like in there is another pediatric center in Oregon that accepts like transgender kids who's in transition or after transition. So we tried that one out. And then, I mean, sometimes like the rest of them, like to be honest, like they just leave out of state when I tell them like our options are just really limited here. Because back then, Seattle Children's, who was like accepting like in-person referral, kind of just stopped as well. So I just tell them like we are out of choices. Like if we can't just do this one, some of them like have to stop, or some of them I really planned ahead, just like I was telling you, like to stockpile on testosterone and or get that prescription just before the injunction. So I kind of covered their bases for that. So it wasn't like a super like everything just got chaotic. I mean, I just want to be a voice for my transgender patients and my future transgender patients that we will still accept you at the clinic. We will do as much as we can by providing care for you. We will still see you for your well child visits, for your regular visits, and we'll do our best to refer you to mental health providers outside. So, I mean, just accept like medication. I mean, these patients are still patients and they still need to be seen. And we will do our best as providers providing gender-affirming care to do as much as we can.
Okay. Dr. Marvin Alviso, family and medicine practitioner in Boise, thanks so much for sitting down to talk with us.
Thanks for having me.
Presentation of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television is made possible through the generous support of the Laura Moore Cunningham Foundation, committed to fulfilling the Moore and Bettis family legacy of building the great state of Idaho, by the Friends of Idaho Public Television, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for Idaho Public Television comes from the School of Public Service at Boise State University, providing objective and impactful research for Idaho and beyond, and academic programs with hands-on learning that equip students to be effective public service leaders.